Okay, welcome. Our topic for today is self-care, not a particularly easy topic. As you have noticed in taking this class, just talking about abuse generates some fairly significant self-care needs. This is not just because, it triggers stuff in our own lives that we may have experienced related to abuse, there's also the kind of, even if you've never experienced any kind of abuse, there is a kind of a vicarious trauma that's associated in hearing other people's stories, being around abusive family dynamics, even if you're not, if you're able to keep yourself, at the edges of that, close enough so that you can be empathic and caring and so on, but not so close as to get sucked in. All those kinds of things create needs for self-care. Most of the stuff I'm going to say about pastoral self-care today isn't really abuse specific. That is, applies in any kind of pastoral situation dealing with any kinds of issues. I may, depending how clear my head is at the end, make some comments about specifically working in abusive situations, but it really pushes you back to looking at pastoral care skills that are going to be useful in a wide variety of situations. Now, the topic of self-care for pastors immediately generates a lot of problems. It's obvious that this is not going to be easy stuff for us. And I've given you a link down on the Moodle page to an article that Dale Woolery, who's head of the Clergy Recovery Network, and I wrote some years ago on the topic of, I think it's called the pedestal syndrome. And that addresses the more systemic sort of issues. Why is it difficult to do self-care when you're in an institution that is anxious about pastors doing self-care? And so I'm going to leave some of the more systemic kinds of issues to that article. You can read it when you have time. I think it captures some really important issues about pastoral self-care. Pastors who are struggling, very few congregations really want to have a pastor that's struggling, regardless of what they might say, regardless of how irrational that is. They want pastors who are shining examples of how all of this works. I know it doesn't work in my life, but I really want to have a pastor who is demonstrating in his life that all this stuff really works for somebody. And that's part of your job, as insane as that really is when it comes right down to it. We're just, broken, damaged, hurting, struggling, missing the mark people just like everybody else. And as I have emphasized before, there is no plan B. There is no pool of pastoral candidates out there who are not broken, damaged, struggling, hurting, missing the mark people. There's just us. And it is, it is a really God's decision to entrust the future of his kingdom to people like us. Get used to it. If you insist on wanting to be part of a congregation that has pastors that don't have problems, God will have to send you to another planet. And that's just the deal. But let me see if I can't summarize briefly the kinds of reasons why we resist good self-care. I've got 5 points. These all overlap and so on. But let me just talk about 5 different ways in which kind of distortions. They're not really cognitive distortions. They're really much more systemic than that inside of us. But they are certainly at least cognitive distortions that underlie our poor self-care patterns that you see among pastors, as you see in any other kind of mental health professional. It's the same sort of issues for therapists, for social workers, for doctors, for nurses, anyone in the helping professions faces some of the same sorts of problems here. The first one is the sense that healthy self-care patterns are just not possible. You can't get there from here. There's no way to do it. One of the ways that played itself out inside of me for many years was this notion that when everyone else is happy and all the work is done, then I'll be able to relax and do appropriate health care. That is as good a one-word summary for the idea of codependency as anything that I can think of. So if you have found yourself deeply embedded in this sort of trying to craft a life out of everybody else being happy and all the work being done, and sort of striving for that, I certainly encourage you to look at that within the frame of codependency. There's lots of literature out there about that. Take a class, take either the class on substance abuse and addictions in the fall, it's taught every fall by Shanae Anderson, or take my class Winter Quarter on, it focuses more on addictions rather than abuse. But there's nothing, I think, more addictive than this notion that when everyone else is happy and the work is done, it is a a fantasy that is very powerful in us. We really want to be able to do that. And what it involves is just postponing any kind of self-care, any kind of appropriate boundaries. It's a utopian vision in many ways, that I will be able to relax and everything will be fine as soon as everybody else is happy. And, it just never quite works out. What you get for this passion is tired. You really get tired and you get sort of resentful and angry that it's not possible to take care of yourself. And I really want to quite explicitly challenge the notion that it's not possible to do appropriate self-care. It is possible to do appropriate self-care. It is achievable. The fact that it never gets to the top of my to-do list tells me something really important about me, something that needs to be changed, because I will never do appropriate self-care. I feel quite comfortable, and I think it's quite accurate to describe myself as a recovering work addict and ministry addict. I lived for many years in this kind of mode, that my job was to make everybody else happy and to get all the work done. And I learned through very hard and painful experiences that this is an unachievable goal and leads to nothing but pain and misery. That is, unfortunately, a sort of voluntary pain and misery. We look back on it and I realize this is what I chose. And it took some very difficult circumstances to get me to face that and to take ownership of that problem and to, recognize that I wasn't so different from everybody else that self-care was impossible for me. I really was like everybody else who struggles to learn how to do self-care, but struggles to learn how to do self-care. And until I started, somehow found the spiritual humility that made it possible for me to start my learning curve in that, I was just, in a whirlwind, in a spiral of the frenzy. Frenzy is one of the words that's, I think, most accurate about the kind of codependency this sort of it's not possible represents. It's a frenzy of doing, a frenzy of trying hard to try harder to try your hardest to make it all work. And in the process, ignoring Sabbath, ignoring rest, ignoring any nurture. It's not just a sort of the addictiveness of that traps us. It can be a very seductive, that kind of life. And that relates to the second point I want to make about poor self-care patterns. It has to do with needing the identity, the sense of value, the connectedness, and the distraction that work provides. Let me talk just a little bit about each of those. Work, I think all work, provides us with a sense of identity, and pastoral work in particular provides us with a sense of who we are. And it's an enormously positive sort of thing. It's one of the benefits of ministry is this sort of identity. I know who I am when I'm helping other people. And I also know how that I have some value when I'm engaged in ministry. I know, I believe that I'm doing things that are important, and that that not just other people value, but God values. So it's like this is an enormously powerful sense of both identity and value that comes from doing the work of the ministry. And I'm also getting sort of regular feedback about being connected to other people. I feel connected in, even for kind of world-class introverts like myself. You get in the doing of ministry a sense of being connected to other people that's very powerful, very positive. We really enjoy this. It's a benefit. We experience it as a benefit. And there's also a fourth thing that doing the work the ministry brings it, or work of any kind can bring. It can bring a distraction. It can distract us from things that we really want to distract ourselves from. And that's going to be different for each of us. And together, all these things tend to be experienced by us as very positive things indeed. They are very positive things: identity, value, connectedness, and the sort of focusing on things that we experience as more pleasant than the things that are going to float to the top when we stop. And there's the problem here. All of these benefits from work, from doing, from engaging in ministry are conditional values. And what happens when we stop is we feel a threat to our identity. Who am I now when I'm not doing this? What's the value of this if it's not ministry? And how am I connected to other people? And when I'm not doing things that distract me from whatever the terrors are in my life that I carry with me, not wanting to look at, what do I do then? Actually, the image that comes to mind here is an image of a vacation. This was early on in ministry. I've got two young kids and maybe 3-4 years in the ministry, enough to have gotten me to the point where I was burnt to a crisp. I had a position in a large church of being kind of the crisis person, did hospital visitation and crisis management largely. And we decided to take a vacation. Thought it was important to take a vacation. We go to we went up to Big Sur to go camping. And of course, people who don't know how to do self-care, like myself at the time, what you do in the 2 weeks before vacation is you work twice or three times as hard as you normally work to get ready for vacation. And you anticipate that when you get back, you'll be working twice or three times as hard as you usually work, because there's all this stuff that's accumulated during your vacation. And you've not arranged for any of this to be done in your absence, because you really enjoy being kind of the essential cog, the essential wheel in this system of care. And it can't really be done without you in your absence. So it feels actually kind of good in a perverse sort of way. There's lots of stuff waiting for you when you get back. But this is what the vacation was like for me affectively. The first day and a half, maybe even 2 days, I don't think I got to day two, but the first two days was just euphoric, you know? I'm out in the wilderness with my family. No one's asking me really to do anything yet. And I just feel completely euphoric. And somewhere between day one and a half and day two, there was this precipitous, just catastrophic collapse into depression. As significant a depression as I've ever experienced. And I'm not sort of given to cycling with euphoria and depression. I'm not manic depressive or any of the milder forms of that kind of cycling. So it was quite notable. And, you know, I think it was certainly, I didn't know what I was doing. What am I supposed to do on this camping trip? Am I supposed to do some sort of ministry with the other people who are camping here? Some sort of ministry with my family? How can I, you know, squeeze some identity into this vacation? Some sense of value, some sense of connection to the larger community. That, I mean, I can certainly work on connection with my family, but I don't have the work here to distract me from the fact that I'm here out in the wilderness with the people that I have been ignoring for the last year, who have been accumulating resentments about Dad not being here, Dad not being available, emotionally available primarily, to the most important people in my life. And so the lack of the distractibility of work meant that here I am now looking at all the stuff that I've been distracting myself from, a wife that has been neglected, kids that aren't getting a father that they really need. And that just flooded in on me and resulted in a very significant depression that lasted, you know, a good part of the remaining vacation until I got back to work. So, that was my treatment program. Now, I think that you can hear in that narrative all the pain, all the that was someone, when I think about myself then, this is 25 years ago or more, someone who lacked any self-care skills, right? I didn't have anything to go on when work stopped. It was just kind of this emptiness, this abyss that I fell into. And I didn't have the resources for those terrors that floated to the top. I didn't know what to do with all that stuff. I had never told anybody about that. I didn't have, you know, a therapist to be working on this with. And so it was, the reasons for poor self-care were really apparent to me. If I start doing self-care, I'm going to crash into this immobilizing depression and lose my sense of identity and my value and my connectedness. And I'm not going to be able to distract myself from the stuff that I really most needed in the whole world to be paying attention to, which is my wife and my kids. That's a pretty powerful motivation not to do appropriate self-care, right? If you start paying those kind of prices. Now, fortunately, there are ways to, I mean, I dug myself out of that mess. It took some time, took a lot of hard work, took, you know, decades of trying things. And I'll talk about the stuff that I think works in just a minute, but I want to make sure you have a pretty clear sense of the problem here. In addition to that sort of work-related identity, value, connectedness, distractibility, there is what sounds like a more cognitive way of resisting this, and that is, I have no limits. Now, nobody says this. I never said that to myself. I never thought that thought. It's something that other people might have concluded about me if they'd looked at my behavior. In fact, they may have rewarded that. It's, you know, here you are at the hospital with us at 3 o'clock in the morning after the traffic accident. And, we're really impressed by your commitment and dedication. And a lot of our failure to do appropriate self-care will be rewarded by other people. They'll see it as commitment and dedication, and that will confuse us. It's sort of rewarding poor self-care. And you can't blame other people for that. You're over-functioning, you're overdoing, and the people are really grateful for that. But it's doing harm that's not being attended to. So we wouldn't say we have no limits, but we live like that, or as it says on the slide, we don't really think we have no limits, but you know, there's some. They're not maybe not too important, and I can take care of them myself. That's the most important thing. I can manage this. I can do this. I can try harder. I can keep going. And if you're sort of still in that kind of mode, living the sort of life that you can control, be in charge of, you have not yet sort of come to terms with the powerlessness of ministry, of a life of ministry, and the sort of powerlessness that you eventually come to the end of your capacities to be strong. It's really then, you know, in those terrible moments when we're forced to recognize the limits that we never wanted to have, that real ministry formation starts, in my view. Because this sort of posturing, yeah, that's kind of a negative word, but I'm going to use it. The kind of posturing that we're attracted to, of being strong enough, being capable enough, being gifted enough, being smart enough, and all eventually comes to an end when we're face to face with our limitations and our brokenness. And the last thing, of course, that we expect is that in that mess, God will see opportunity. And, you know, it wasn't until Gideon had nothing that God saw the opportunity to win a victory. Ponder these things. Second, the fourth sort of distortion, both cognitive and more systemic, is that my needs don't really matter. Now, this usually has deep roots, the notion that my needs don't matter. I certainly acquired this very early in life, and so do most of us. You know, mom and dad are busy now. Your needs don't matter. Or they're distracted. They're distracted by substance abuse or distracted by whatever frenzy is going on in their life and just don't have time. Your needs don't really matter. And the, I can't remember if I told the story about the woman who was the last woman in line. It really fits here, so let me say it again in sort of a brief version. This is a woman who crashed and burned, a pastor who had a wonderful ministry, had done wonderful things in her life, and was crashing and burning in midlife. She came in my office, and we talked, and I asked her what the Christian life was like, and she said, well, wherever you are, how much stuff you have, your job as a Christian is to turn to people who have less than you and give. That's what the Christian life was like, was giving. And the metaphor emerged in her speech about this was that everybody's in this long line on the planet, one big long line. Everybody's lined up from the people who have the most stuff to people who have the least stuff. And wherever you are, turn to the people who have less and give that way. And I asked her if there was anybody whose principal job was to receive, and she was completely stumped about this whole notion of receiving. There just wasn't any place for it in the Christian life. In the end, she said, after about 5 minutes of just silence and thinking about it, she said, well, there's got to be a last person in line who doesn't have anybody who has less. And you could give to that person, but that person doesn't have anything to give. And so they just have to receive. And I remember telling her, you are the last person in line. You have nothing to give. All you can do is receive. Find some way to receive. This was a very disorienting and disturbing and challenging thought to her, because she had lived a life based on the notion that her needs don't matter. God's busy with important stuff was part of that. It also had very much to do with Mom and Dad had a bunch of important stuff to pay attention to. This is not an uncommon sort of thing. She happened to be the daughter of missionaries. I don't want to pick on missionaries here, but missionary kids and pastor's kids tend to have this because Mom and Dad are really preoccupied with really important stuff. I mean, if you work for God, what's more important than that? And it's important for me as a kid not to let my needs get in the way of what God's doing. Okay, so my needs really don't matter. So self-care, it's connected with the next point I'm making, point five, and that is it sort of feels selfish and sinful, self-care does. Giving is what God and others expect of me. Anything less than this would be selfish and therefore sinful. How in the world are you going to do appropriate self-care if it's always feeling internally like it's selfish, you know? And if you come out of a tradition where selfishness is the primordial sin, then it just feels like if you're not giving all the time, you're taking a minute to take care of yourself, you're doing something really, really, really wrong. And sort of you have this theological frame which reinforces this notion that the self is bad and any attentiveness to your own needs is selfishness. Seems to me I put a link above in an earlier lecture to an interview with Ray Anderson, former systematics professor at Fuller, now deceased. I interviewed him a number of years ago about the self. I'd recommend reading that if this is a theological issue for you. It certainly gets in the way of self-care. If you think that the basic Christian thing is to be giving, I would suggest to you that giving is the central preoccupation of a central religious paradigm that has dominated our species for most of its history. Most religions come up with the notion that you need to be giving to God. That's your primary obligation. And I think I talked about this some before, how confusing it must have been to Abraham, for example, to God, to have God come out of nowhere and say, here's the deal I'm going to give to you. There would have been nothing in his religious world that reinforced that notion, because all the religious instincts and sensibilities were, we're supposed to give to God. God's hungry, so feed God. God's angry, so placate him. God's something, so give to God. And the notion that fundamentally our relationship to God is receiving, that God's the one who feeds us, God who feeds us with spiritual food, God who nurtures his people. That was just, is a revolutionary notion. It turns everything upside down and is part of the reason why the Christian faith, I think, is so revolutionary. It suggests that this sort of frame of giving to God doesn't capture the heart of faith at all. It is finding the spiritual humility to receive that is at the heart of the Christian faith, in my view. It's why faith itself, which is not something we give, but something we receive, is so important. Now, I've wandered off into systematics here, so I'm going to bring myself back. Let me suggest, so this doesn't go on forever, the few things that might actually be helpful in developing appropriate self-care plans. The first thing, you probably might have guessed already from what you've heard in this class so far, is it has to do with telling the truth. And I mean this in a very, very practical sense. I don't just mean say true things, but be the kind of person who has a capacity for recognizing the truth about things and who is able to see them. If your strategy for self-care is I'm going to take do appropriate self-care things when everybody's happy and all the work is done, the important thing is to notice the truth about that. That time never comes. So learn to tell the truth about that kind of stuff. If I think I'm just being responsible and dedicated and committed, but other important people in my life, most importantly my spouse or my children, say, "You're never here for us," learn to notice the truth about that. Other people are seeing things that are hard for us to receive as truthful, but they have better access to what's true about that than we do. So find some way to tolerate the truth. It's often painful truths that we need to pay attention to. That's why telling the truth to ourselves is particularly important. It's also important to learn to tell the truth to other people. It may be really important to tell the church board the truth about how well I'm functioning. That I've tried harder. I've tried my hardest, and I'm now tired. This doesn't work. This is not a job. The way I'm doing this job doesn't have human proportions to it. I'm somehow acting like I'm not a creature with limits, and we need to take this seriously. Now, that may not sound like a big baby step. In fact, telling it to the church board, you may lose your job, I don't know. But certainly telling the truth to yourself, telling the truth to the safest people in your life. If you have no person that's safe enough to talk about this kind of stuff with, then get your butt into therapy. Seriously. You need a therapist. You need someone who you can talk to about this stuff. Sometimes friends are enough. Sometimes there's a community of pastoral support. Sometimes, there's ways to cobble together structures that are very effective places where it's safe to tell the truth about this stuff without going to someone that you pay to tell them this stuff. I'm a big fan of that option. I think it's the best money I ever spent in life. Do whatever you have to do to create safe places to tell the truth about the problem here. That's not the whole solution, but telling the truth about the impact this very dysfunctional form of life is having on me is a really important part of getting any place else. Taking ownership of the problem. This echoes, of course, Juanita's presentation. This sort of you're observing, having observed the truth, taking some ownership is the next stage. This involves lots of things. It involves the sort of the rejection of blame. This mess is not what other people did to me. I chose this. I got benefits out of this. It felt really good to have an identity and a purpose, and it felt good to be able to keep the lid on the terrors of my life by just working hard. But it's important. It may take some time. My initial response to being a creature, to being a limited person, was anger at other people in my life for they're asking too much of me. Angry at the church, angry at my wife, I can't keep up, and that makes me really angry at other people who are expecting me to do too much. That's a way of evading taking ownership of the problem. This series of behaviors is behaviors that I engaged in because they provided benefits to me. And I need to take full ownership of having made those decisions. Share the problem is a little bit more than just telling the truth about it. This is sort of having a community of people that you can walk together with in responding to this problem. This is really about having a community of people who are committed to doing appropriate self-care. Sometimes you can get this in, spiritual formation groups. Sometimes a group of like-minded pastors can form to help each other. You don't just need, not a big fan of accountability groups, because 9 times out of 10, it turns out to be another place where you feel bad about not doing enough of what it is you're supposed to be doing now. And another group of people will beat up on you. Maybe not. There's some wonderful accountability structures there that are not shaming structures. If you can find one that's not too steeped in shame, that could be a wonderful resource for you as well. The fourth thing that might help is learning to tolerate grace. If grace just seems like this wonderful, good, free, great thing, fine. But I think once you start working in this territory, you'll find that grace is difficult to swallow, that it's challenging, that it's, God's strength made perfect in our weakness has our weakness right there, right? That is not easy for us to tolerate. We don't like that kind of thing. It frightens us. It triggers us. It's connected with all kinds of other things inside of us that make it the kind of thing that we can only increase our tolerance for in little steps. That is, I think you can look at my history of commitments to different local churches and see sort of gradual increase in capacity to tolerate grace. I couldn't go to a really graceful church early on. I had to go to a church that was just a little bit more graceful than what I knew. Something that had more grace than that was just terrifying. I couldn't go there. So I needed to have a place that had enough shame to sort of match my internal experience, but was at least a step in the right direction. Give yourself room for those step in the right direction moves. And give your congregation room for that. You start doing grace all of a sudden in a congregation, people might choke on it. It might be too much. So you give people the grace of doing this in a stepwise fashion and give yourself that same kind of grace. Learning to keep the Sabbath, learning how to rest and play is a really important piece. If your judgmental self is in charge here still, remind your judgmental self that obeying the commandment to do Sabbath is really important, okay? So even if you do it out of obligation, I think that's maybe where we have to start. That's where I started. I found that I had to do Sabbath. It was an obligation, and I can do it much more joyfully now, much more with the sense of how integrated that is in the kind of lifestyle that I've been able to receive. But doing Sabbath starts in small steps. I think I talked once in class about going to the beach and doing crosswords. Smallest possible element of rest. Take it in small doses and then think about that, process that with other people, share it. Remember, I love live jazz. At least I love certain kinds of live jazz. I'm a post-bop aficionado. So I like kind of jazz at the edge of insanity. I love going out to hear it live. It's very empowering and enriching. I can't explain that. It could be some sort of brain damage. But I do love that stuff. And I remember early on our first experiences of going to little jazz clubs in Southern California. It actually has a pretty decent jazz scene if you look for it. I just felt nothing but anxiety going to this club. I wasn't doing anything particularly Christian for an hour during this set. I wasn't witnessing to anybody. I wasn't feeling deeply Christian thoughts. I was just feeling this wonderful music. And I didn't have a place to put that. Well, the place to put that was Sabbath. It was this little teeny bit of Sabbath that I was somehow in the beginning tricking myself into enjoying, trying to enjoy. I was just anxious at first, but just because you're anxious at first doesn't mean you can't learn. And that's what I had to do. I had to learn Sabbath. I had to practice Sabbath. And it came in very small increments. Taking a whole day felt like an enormous challenge at the beginning. I can do a good deal of Sabbath without feeling that old anxiety. You know, the fears are all going to be, I'm just going to get lazy and I'm going to get less committed. No, what you get is restored so that your commitment has some traction to it. You can actually do something with it instead of being exhausted and depleted all the time. You start to refill the resources that you need to actually do ministry. Lastly, something I always recommend, and this I don't know much how this is much of this is shaped by the fact that I'm talking to Fuller students, but I just think that there is a real importance to renounce the striving for perfection. Find some way to renounce this. I've often wished that the church had structures where we could renounce our idolatrous attachments. The church, you know, just kind of assumes if you're showing up at church, you've already on the right spiritual path, and we're just going to encourage you to do more, and doesn't really provide structures and incentives to stand up and say, I've served a perfectionist God, and I renounce this spiritual attachments. I will not serve this God anymore. That's where I am spiritually, and I refuse to be perfect. I encourage you to refuse to be perfect. I know when it just seems like that's the most godly thing you could possibly do, thing that you could possibly strive for, may be messing with your brain a bit to think that it's really spiritually important to renounce perfection. It's not achievable, ain't going to happen, and the energy and passion that most of us experience around goals like that aren't really dedication and commitment. They're typically attachments to gods who are not God, those gods that are impossible to please. So find some way, as a part of the appropriate self-care process, to refuse to be perfect. I have sometimes suggested, finding some class during your time at Fuller, not this one, finding some class to get a C in. That would force the issue, wouldn't it? I know for many people, feel like just disastrous, catastrophic. Maybe shoot for a B minus. Yeah. Try for a B minus in some class sometime. It'll force the issue of perfection. Life will force the issue of the fact that we are not perfect. There's no way around that. This is not an optional activity in life. If you're, it's not like I'm suggesting something that you aren't going to have to deal with in the normal course of things. You will have to deal with not being perfect. And if your only strategy for not being perfect now is to just beat the crap out of yourself and feel really bad and awful and depressed, what I'm suggesting is find a better strategy for dealing with not being perfect. It's kind of hardwired into who you are, right? Creatures are not the creator. And we are not perfect. We are broken, damaged, hurting, struggling, missing the mark folks. Make some room for that. It will be a lot easier to do that as a kind of intentional spiritual practice than it will be to have life force us to do that. I think in my case, it was pretty much forced on me by the realities of life. And I think to engage in spiritual practices that help us build some more spiritual humility than that would be really good. So find some way to do a confession. Find some way to do the practice of the social disciplines that lead towards spiritual humility. It will pay off big time in the long haul. The last thing you need to do is to look at my list of things that might help. And to sort of do them all perfectly, that's not what's going to take you where you want to go here. I mean, I feel like I know this class well enough now by just observing your participation in the forum, principally, I guess, to have a sense of what wonderful human beings you are and how delightful and how much you have to offer the Christian community. And it would be a huge shame for you to put all that at risk by finding yourselves in a place where self-care just can't get done. And I think of it the same way I think about going to the gym. It took me 45 years to realize that I needed to go to the gym. It was good for me. I was going to enjoy it. I couldn't imagine that. I couldn't imagine actually enjoying going to the gym and working out. It turns out to be one of the things that if I don't do it now, I don't feel right. I really need, it's like, it's good enough that I notice the benefit. Self-care doesn't start off like that. It starts off the way starting off going to the gym started off for me. It just aches and pains. And I just, why am I doing this? I don't want to go. I got other important things for this time. Is this really important? And it ends up, if you do it enough, you find, can't imagine living without this. This is so good and such a rich part of life. Doing physical self-care is like this. And I think doing spiritual self-care and psychological self-care is the same. If you can do it just going out and exercise, that's fine. If you need a gym, go to the gym. If you need a trainer, get a trainer. Do whatever needs to be done to take care of yourself because you are... God has never forgotten, not for a beat of your heart, how precious you are, and wants self-care to be a rich and stable part of your life for the rest of your life. So, blessings. Thanks for listening to me rant about this. I encourage you, since I do not have a lecture for the second half of this week, to... if there's stuff that you that I did not talk about in this class in particular, just start a thread in the forum, and I'll see if I can't talk. I'm going to be quite present there in the next few days.